Well, Michael and I would like to welcome you back to another recording of the Saturn-Earth Connection. Our website is helloearth.info, and today is Tuesday, February 23rd, 2016, and this is our 302 with Michael from Maui, Hawaii. Michael was taken to a huge luminescent sphere near Saturn as a student visitor and returned to Maui with their amazing flowing dialogue, and occasionally we hear from Shaharon using Michael to transmit his voice into the recording. And I want to thank James from North Wales, Pennsylvania. Thank you, James, for keeping the hours hosted on the web. Everybody appreciates that. Thank you. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Curtis.
Hi, welcome back. Sound like you have another microphone.
Oh, no, it's the same one.
Oh, okay. Well, it sounds good today. And just a cool, wet day here and talking with you in Maui, and maybe Shaharon is listening out near Saturn. Some people I know in New Zealand listen. Wendy listens. Kathleen's in the middle of the country. Lawrence is close by here. Len's in Utah. Mike's in Utah. Brian's in Boston. Jay's in Canada. So, it's pretty spread out. But Wendy sent an email about how spread out things are.
Mm-hmm.
Subject matter is universe architectural spheres. And she gives a link, which I didn't get to yet, but it's up posted on the site, on the listen page. She writes, "Dear gents, I recently came across this presentation of the architectural spheres, which I thought you might find of interest as Michael visited only one of the 647,591 architectural spheres in the universe of Nebulon. I shall refrain from letting my imagination roam freely for eternity will be required for us to view the many stopping places prepared in the Father's universes. With loving greetings from a small island in the South Pacific known as New Zealand, signed, Wendy." Well, it is a big universe, and I just mentioned your email to Michael before we started recording and said, can you imagine landing at that many airports and going in town to walk through the museums? It's a big universe, but we think our planet is our only universe. So always looking forward to Tannenella to stop by here once again. I know I saw them once, but they've probably cruised by before. But they know where we are and know what we're up against. So you've told us about that architectural world. And do you think the other architectural worlds or spheres are identical or the same, or what do you know about them, Michael?
Well, as I said before, the uniqueness of the New Jerusalem, or the New Jerusalem, whichever way you want to pronounce it, both are correct, according to how I was told the name and discussed it. One of the important factors about the New Jerusalem is the fact that it is luminescent. It gives off light. And most other architectural spheres absorb light. They do not even reflect light. So the uniqueness of this is it's almost as if it wants to be seen. And in character, all spheres that are based, or you might say owned, by the universe creator sun are luminescent. They glow. And that is a definite characteristic of the New Jerusalem.
Okay, you're back.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what that was, but it was a bunch of static.
Yeah. Okay, and that that glow, or you know, the radiance of it was described as a field. I thought it was, I said it was a force field, you know, back in the concept was set 1970s, people used the term force field a lot, and not understanding, you know, it's, we do have a force field for our planet, which is our electromagnetic field or our magnetic field. There's a more and more people realizing it is generated by induced electromotive energy of our actual planet, and not something that is inherent like a bar magnet, you know, just magnetized. It is continually generated, and there are times in which it does get perturbed by other, you know, like a another magnetic field or and pressure, magnetic or pressure, electromagnetic or electrostatic pressure, and these things have caused various phenomena. But in terms of the field about the New Jerusalem, is really, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that it is almost like a signpost. Here we are. This is the, you might call it a type of capital city of a zone or area. And we, and being called the New Jerusalem, which is the Jerusalem, which is the capital of this 600 some odd planets of Satania's system. And at being called the New Jerusalem, you know, are there any new towns like New York and other, you know, things around that are called new that you know of around you?
Well, they when they landed in when the Hudson, when Henry Hudson sailed up the Hudson River. They called the New York City, they called it New Amsterdam.
Yeah. For the reason,
because they were from Amsterdam and this was like their new place, and so that's kind of what they used to do in those days.
Yeah. And it's because then when you look at that idea of New Amsterdam. Have you been to Amsterdam?
I wish. No, I haven't.
Oh, I've been there.
I'd love to go there.
Yeah, and there's no comparison, essentially. You know, there's a, the comparison is that Amsterdam, of course, is a major port town that's very old. They historically, you know, are showing their sailing heritage of the Dutch, you know. That went around the world as great traders, you know, as, and they were trading at the same time as you know, master navigators of the planet, as the Spanish. But it is definitely not New York or New Amsterdam, if you want a word called New York, New Amsterdam. New York is a much greater, you know, town or village or whatever it started off to be, to became a, you know, the, one of the great city of New York, and that's a now an old city, you know, in terms of the many that are out there that are being built today. China's building cities out of without inhabitants and hoping that they'll come later on. And they're kind of filling up right now in China, but that depends upon the fact that how much economic energy they can leak off of the free world. And the key behind the free world is the USA, of course. So anyway, that gives you a hint on the idea of the New Jerusalem in our solar system and the position of our planet. And then we, of course, are just one of 600-odd planets in the system, but very special in the entire system of Nebadon. So you might say that the New Jerusalem or the New Jerusalem is going to have a, you might call it, a high destiny of greatness, because it's not, they've told me very clearly that it has not stopped growing. It is under continual growth. They didn't call it construction, they call it growth. And they showed me how it works, and it's almost like, I'm not sure exactly, but they pop in cells, you know, and these cells are habitations, like apartments in many areas. They serve, they're functional in that way, and they're about maybe 20 to 30 feet in diameter. They kind of are like, they're kind of like a M&M's candy on the side, if you were to look at it, you know. That's what it looks like, and they just continually popping them in place all the time, and growing them in place. And I'm kind of asking them, what happens with, you know, when it takes that space? What happens with the rest? The entire structure actually gets bigger. You know, it's growing outwardly. You know, to make that happen. So, as it's growing these cells, which are habitations, they keep getting a bigger diameter. And this is the way the New Jerusalem is constructed. I'm not sure about the rest of the... How many were there? How many hundreds of thousands are in Lebanon?
Wendy wrote there were 647,591 architectural spheres.
Yeah, and that's not very many if you were to think about them as buildings. But when it comes down to the New Jerusalem, it's basically a baby. You know, it's in comparison to the old ones. The capital, Jerusalem, is an architectural sphere many, 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 many times larger. It would take up space well past that of the size of planet Earth, you know. So it's been around for a while. But the New Jerusalem, by hint only, not directly being told, by hint, and that hint was that when you go to Rome, you'll notice, you know, how new this place is and how old the ruins of Rome look, because that place looks brand new. It looks like beautifully polished floors. Walls are just absolutely pristine. There's no sharp corners, by the way. Everything is a curve. And it's, I guess, a characteristic of how it grows, the construction, or how it grows. And like, we have no sharp corners on, you know, a tree. You know, some of them look sharp, but they really have a curve to them. Otherwise, they'll break right off. Sometimes you look at the points on, but it's not the same as saying that the tree doesn't have any. You know, it's all as if it was pure straight lines. When it comes down to the structure of architectural sphere, I believe they differ in many ways. But one of the keys behind the character of the New Jerusalem as a sun sphere, a creator sun sphere, is that it gives off light. Yeah, so it manages energy in a different way. The other spheres are not able to be observed. And maybe the concept of what Zechariah Sitchin was able to come up with in terms of Nibiru being a inhabited world that had a type of containment for their atmosphere. In other words, in a sphere that went around their habitation that was structured with gold particles, nanoparticles, to keep it functioning. But it also had, if it is of a characteristic as other architectural spheres, it would not reflect light. It would not even have any light. In other words, it would be almost undetectable in terms of using any form of telescopic observation that uses various wavelengths of light, whether it be visible light spectrum or go to the deep infrared or the ultraviolet ends of the spectrum. Radio is another area. All those things are, you might call them energy sources. Mm-hmm. And energy sources that are able to be tapped. And as they're tapped, they're, you know, you basically do not have a reflection. They're used for the generation or recycling of energy, because space is not empty. It's filled with not only matter, but a tremendous amount of energy that is, some of it in flux, some of it is flowing around. In terms of the electrodynamics of the universe, I'm absolutely positive that the universe is an electric universe, having key components of it being electrical in its nature. This is one of the strong points I came away with from just question and answer sessions with the celestial, you know, and their comments of electrostatic energies and similarities between the dynamics of magnetism and electrical energy. So the universe is highly electrical in nature, and there is also the fact that their energy, electrical energy, does not necessarily move, and it can stay very stable. And static is one of them. You would never know the energy in a capacitor. It's just there until you form a circuit that, you know, basically gives it a point of flow. It's almost like it's just can be held in containment. And some of the energies in the universe are like that. Hmm. And yeah, so they know how to. But the key behind that in architectural spheres, for the vast majority of them, are they absorb energy. They don't give off energy. Mm-hmm. The sun, in his creative ability, that is his major characteristic of the creator sun, is that it gives off, you might say, life energy, light energy, and various other forms of energy, because as a creator sun, he is a conduit of, you might say, the building blocks of a universe. And that is the primary reason for having it radiant.
The suns are the building blocks of the universe?
The creator suns. Each universe, sub-universe, or local universe has a creator sun. And the local universe that we're functioning with is the universe of Nebadon. And as Nebadon has sectors or constellations and subunits, gets broken up into smaller and smaller pieces until we finally end up with ourselves as part of the solar system. You know, but the key being is this solar system has an architectural sphere of high importance. extremely high importance.
Well, it's important to us.
Well, it's important to the universe, the entire universe, because the universe the entire universe of Nebadon is a young universe that has not yet fully matured in terms of its organization. And the organization of Nebadon has to settle and into a stable state of described as light and life. The light, of course, being the light of the Creator Sun's source, which comes back from the first source and center. So that stabilizes it in terms of great amounts of peace. But the universe is in its creative state. Goes through the struggle of the mixture of different energies that compose and create the accumulation of matter that ends up with stars forming, the breaking up of stars, which ends up in more matter, more sophisticated matter. I kind of look at this idea of, you know, gold being mined in so many different ways. If it were the composition of our planet in a geologic form where it has to be kind of like squeezed out of the crust or the deeper mantle. Then you would find it kind of clumped up and sometimes in tubes or something. But there, a great majority of it is actually found on the surface, right on the surface, and not in the form of tiny particles, nanoparticles, but actually formed in dust and nuggets. Right on the surface. And that tells me that our planet has been dusted by the stardust of blown up suns, you know, that we have been cruising through or have had something cruise through that where it was a blown up sun, you know, at one time. It has a lot of very sophisticated matter in it, and one of which is not prone to decomposition or oxidation or whatever form of entropy you want to use. It stays as a very, very pristine material, gold, and find it laid on the in certain areas, like it was, like certain areas of the planet were dusted over. Wow, what did that? You know, and it's an amazing thing. It was just like imported onto the planet's surface. So that tells me that, you know, as far as material goes, well, there's a lot of material that we've gathered through time and through space, movements on this planet. Some of it only traced down to the age of the woolly mammoth. So something happened there that during that time that also dusted the planet with a lot of gold. It's interesting that they found out that when people found these tusks of woolly mammoth, that gold was laid up right along the same layer that mammoth died in. So that dusting must have been a pretty severe one. But it left a lot of gold on the surface, which later got covered over. So that's interesting in terms of what these gold miners are finding. And when you think about the idea of streets of gold and all of that is descriptive in terms of gold's material. One of the key characteristics of the landing bay is that it's not black tar. You know, it doesn't look that way. It has the a metallic sheen to it, golden or yellowish metal, you know, it's like so odd. But when it comes right down to it, it's extremely polished, crystalline structure. Apparently able to charge, I guess, charge up some of these little ships or the big ones. They're all in the bay and gathering energy that way too. So the energy sources are also very interesting too. The frondelings on the ships, the architectural spheres are not generators, they're regulators. In other words, energy that just freely flows. It's sort of like, you know, kind of catching these energies and then, you know, regulating them to a point in which can be useful, and then allowing these energies to continue on their way. So that's another interesting things about the way energy is not generated but used, rather the actual regulation of free flowing energy. It's sort of like a dam. If you look at that, you have the fact that water flows downhill, and of course you never really stop its flow downhill. You just sort of entrap it, and then by, you know, causing it to turn a few mechanical items and make some changes through the Tesla design of electromagnetic loops of wire that generate electricity. The frondelings have a way of doing similar sense, but not with only electricity, but with another form of energy that I was trying to get the answer to, but didn't quite capture it in my understanding.
You mean another form of energy that the frondelings were capturing or collecting?
Yes. It's not. I asked specifically, is this electrical energy? And they said there's some in it, in what is being regulated, but there's also some another. They also said specifically there's water flowing through there too. So there's a byproduct, which could very well mean that it could be a type of fusion. You know, H hydrogen and two oxygens, you know, H2O make water. If you fuse, you know, hydrogen and oxygen, you make water. Could be. It's a byproduct, but there's an immense flow of another form of energy, which is much closer to life energy. It is, you might say, the river of life concept. There is a river of life that we don't know about. So it was being taught by Jesus Christ that you would have access to that in heaven or in the celestial environment.
You'd have access to this river of life on the New Jerusalem, or?
Definitely, it's functioning there. Yeah.
And, you know, for our simple minds, we think, well, we need electricity to make this thing glow. And didn't you say that, or I've heard, they've turned it on and turned it off, that glow of the New Jerusalem out near Saturn?
Yeah, they can modulate it. It can actually become a light show if you wanted it to be that way. In the picture that we caught, you know, you have it. It's the same one that the pilot who stood by the shuttlecraft. I was inside of it, and as the observation window became clear, transparent, he stood there, and it was right side up. In other words, it looked, the whole sphere had that look of his head. You know, it's kind of like, doesn't it look like me? Doesn't it look like me? Hey, no, get it? And I'm over there, yes, it looks like you, but there's so many other things I want to know about it. Yeah, so that was just at the first appearance. And what is the light from? Is that a force field? And describe it as a field, not a force. So it was a field of, there wasn't a force that was, you know, pushing upon you. It was a field of energy that was radiating. And it includes the energy of light energy, but of life energy.
So this illumination certainly looked different than a sun.
Oh, definitely. You could look right into it. No problem. Yeah, it didn't hurt your eyes at all.
So you knew it wasn't a sun. It wasn't just like, oh, here's no. a...
I mean, you turned around and you asked me, where's the sun? And all you had to do was look for the brightest star. Mm-hmm. And the sun is absolutely beautiful from there. From the perspective in which I was at, it's all the way out at Saturn. You know, the sun now is a star, essentially. The brightest star in the sky.
But you can't look at it at all. I mean, it's just way too bright.
No, you can. You can look directly.
You mean out there? You mean out there?
Out there, yeah. It hasn't gone through the atmosphere to diffuse the light, which makes the light much more unbearable for ourselves to see, to look at. It looks closer to an arc welder's arc way out there. That's that shockingly bright spot. But it's so far away, and the black of space.
It's 10 times further away? 10 or 15 times further away?
Than the sun is to Earth?
Than the sun is to Earth.
I'm not sure.
Saturn's exactly. Pretty far out there.
Yeah, way out there, yeah.
But I'm just guessing maybe 10 times.
Looking at it, and well, it is reduced by the square of the distance, yeah. So that's, yeah.
So did it appear to be like 1/10 of the intensity that we see it as? But we're looking at it through atmosphere.
Yeah, but much, much, much lower, because the energy of the sun's radiance diminishes logarithmically downhill.
Well, on the International Space Station, they're pretty much out of most of the atmosphere.
Right.
So they can get a clear look at the... I mean, it is really bright when you look at it from when they have the camera. You see sunrise and sunset every 45 minutes. It's
much stronger. Much stronger at our position. Even if it out at the International Space Station, there's no atmosphere to diffuse the light. So it's still
much stronger.
Strong light. But
remember the Apollo astronauts, how they had that Hasselblad camera just attached to their chest? Mm-hmm. And when you looked at it, there was no housing on the camera. Mm-hmm. So it must, and they it wasn't digital. They had, you know,
film in it.
Film.
Yeah.
You know, light sensitive, heat sensitive film. So that would have just baked out there, that film. I used to have an underwater casing for my camera that I would take under the under the surface of the ocean.
Yeah.
And it had a housing for the ocean. Well, there was no housing for being in space.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I heard, the sun is awful hot without the atmosphere diffusing it.
Yeah.
So the International Space Station, they're right out there in that bright environment. So the sun looked, tell me more about how it looked when you were out there, when you looked back at it. You said it didn't hurt your eyes.
No, it didn't hurt my eyes, but it was very beautiful. So you might call it a, you know, like the most beautiful star you ever saw, because its radiance is beautiful, like a bright diamond, you know, just out there. And we got pictures that capture the sun from. We even captured the Earth, little tiny blue dot, you know. From Mars, I was able to point it out through the observation. They asked me, do you know where Earth is? First thing I did was turn and look and easily found the sun. And then kind of looked around a bit. And there it was, you know, Earth was there, blue dot, you know. And it said, there it is. And it says, okay, put your hands here and steer us back. Yeah, and it says, their hands are different. They're not like mine. My fingers are too short. He said, no, they're just markers. Just put your hand over there. And I did, and we piloted back to Earth. First way outside of Earth, and then much closer later on. And finally I said, no, I'm not doing this. You guys do the rest.
So in the beginning of this, you were speaking about the field, the magnetic field that we have.
Yes.
Around us, you said it was continually generated, and you know, we've all messed around with a compass. Has a little pin in the middle and a balancing arm. One side is red, and that points to north or magnetic north. But the field is very weak to spin that. It is not like a strong magnet that you have in your other hand.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, it's the, you know, the Earth, she's a real big compared to that little tiny compass you have in your hand. So this magnetic field that is around the Earth, how strong and powerful is that field if it's captured a different way? And also the glow of that New Jerusalem. So where did that energy come from? I guess they're producing that in that
Remember now,
veranda deck?
No, the veranda deck is a being, a high being.
I don't mean the veranda deck. I mean the
Frondelink.
The Frondelink.
Yeah, the Frankenstein's.
Yeah, the Frankenstein thing.
Yeah, Frankenstein. That's my memory trick to remember. If it sounds like a Frankenstein, and I ever find the guy is describing it as some, if it has to do with energy, that's the exact word.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Frondelink.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought I'd never be able to remember Frondelink, you know, but I could remember Frankenstein in relation to some energy generation or engine. That's the term I want. I want to see the engine. Oh, energy source. You want to know the energy source. Can you rev it up? Rev it up. Oh, you want to increase power demand. Increase power demand. Okay. Power output, power demand.
Well, if you're ability. Creating more demand, where's that extra energy coming from?
It's coming from the absolute free energy. It is a genuinely real energy source that was removed from the planet. Initially, they were implanted upon the planet. Apparently, it needs an extremely stable base. And the pyramids held one, the big pyramid. The others are copies. That was not the only one. There are many that were implanted about the planet. Interestingly, where the Great Pyramid is the exact center of mass of the world. So if you were to look at the center of mass of all the continents, it would be right in the Great Pyramid, which is the absolute perfect point of distribution of energies. And the energies not necessarily being electrical energy or some kind of dynamic energy that we, you know, would think like wind energy or solar energy, some kind of energy, but an energy that the Fond du Lacs are well capable of. And one of them was a byproduct was water. And there was great amount of evidence that there's a lot of water that was kind of moving around near the pyramids at one time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they were removed because of the Lucifer rebellion, because of the fact that Lucifer had hijacked the planet and the origin, the planetary origin beings, the human race, which had become, you might call it, resonant to the divine voice, and were receptive to the thought adjuster or the divine fragment, the fractal of God. And when they were hijacked, there was a thought that it could still be brought back through the Adamic infusion, Adam and Eve's. Adam and Eve's came, and they were hijacked also. So the confusion was that they thought they would still be able to elevate the planet, both in terms of civilization as well as genetically. But they had done it in a way that was out of the natural flow of the planet's development. And because of that, the uniqueness of the human race was almost lost. And instead we have now a hybrid race. The human race is a hybrid race, not a purely Earth race or unique to planet Earth. One of the things that makes creativity of the universe creator so beautiful is the fact that even if you have and you can classify planets, they're never the same, or they classify stars, and they're never the same. You classify even down to each individual plant, and there, when you look at them, they're not the same. They're unique, and that uniqueness was almost lost for the human race, and it was to be patterned not against the human race's own pattern of development, but an artificial one, which was not in alignment with the divinity purpose of the human race. In other words, the human race was no longer on a divine ascent path. It was instead on a path of being a smart animal, you know, and actually having no higher destiny beyond life limitation. You know, life limitation would be the length of a lifespan. Okay. But the problem ended up being that even those that came, like the Adam and Eve, were essentially supposed to be eternal and without death. The tree of life was lost, and when the tree of life was lost, they lost the infusion of the regeneration necessary to keep material bodies renewed. So they aged out and died. And so did much of the rebels who functioned, which has left the human race with, their natural short lives and a destiny that they didn't know what it was. And today, and even today, the human race, if you ask them, what is the purpose of life? They go, well, that's something I don't know. Well, I mean, you can ask the greatest philosophers, and they don't know, you know. And, well, if you go to the Christians say, to be saved, so they won't go to hell. Well, what's hell? Punishment for doing wrong things. Well, what's the wrong thing? Well, you know, the whole idea is that once separated from the divine path or knowing God, the end is sort of like you know, falling off a cliff. It just happens. And but once realizing personal destiny or this destiny of a human race, one can capture and align one's life toward the divine voice, which is very quiet, and be led by the stability of light and life, which is love, and the stability of truth, the stability, the stabilizers. And by becoming acutely aware of the stabilizers, one's life stabilizes also into the divine destiny program. And then you can kind of like navigate a very interesting life, because added to one's life are the celestial agents, you might call them guardian angels, who help not just to keep you out of trouble, but to give you a full and wonderful life, full of experience and destiny. And they'll just keep, you know, at the proper time, add it to your life dimension. So the first point, of course, is to realize your divine destiny by first trying to and continually trying to attune to God or to the divine voice, which is not made up in, you know, basic laws of, you know, behavior. That was just to take man from a more primitive state to be able to become more civilized so they could hear the real divine voice. And then at that point, hearing that divine voice, continually being led by it to come forward with the illumination of the divine way, which is evident for us in terms of seeing the light. That's what you might call it, that, because that's pretty much what happens to a person, is that they realize, and this instantaneously ignites the activity of the thought adjuster, the activity of the divine voice. And more and more we become acute to it, or we can become deaf to it. And the idea is not to become deaf to it. The idea is to become acutely aware and have a very trained consciousness to bring in. That's why the basic prayer was given by Jesus Christ as saying that the will of God, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In heaven, you have light and life. In heaven, you have affinity and attunement. And the will of God is accomplished through his living beings, who are free agents yet align themselves to, you might call it, the will of God as composers of his will. And on the planet Earth, if we do the same thing, we essentially bring his will to Earth as it is in heaven. So the instruments of it is not through some artificial means or some means of implantation, which was already ruined by the initial Adamic influence and the prior influence of another group of agents, you might call them. The Urantia book calls them the Kalagastia 100. His group, which was supposed to kind of more observe than really influence. Yeah, so that hijacking took place, and we're stuck with that basic problem, which is, what is the purpose of all of this? You know, you go through life, you gain skill, gain knowledge and wisdom, all to die and be put in a box and buried. That's where I was at, you know, as a kid, carrying my grandfather's coffin. I was in the middle, you know, there were six, you could have six people carrying him, so I was in the middle because I couldn't carry much. I was too little. But I was carrying him and thinking that all the way through, Grandpa's in the box. He went through this whole life, and I'm looking forward to his, you know, his matching his, at least his age, 88 years or something like that. Nice age. But what is that? If I go through 88 years, what is this all about? Well, the first thing I did was try to look for the purpose of life and figure, well, there's some master that must be called God, because that's what people call him, you know. And the discovery and the idea finally came up, looking at a various form of a non-God philosophy. Ultimately challenging the reality of God, and then finding a Taninella being sent to me for confirmation of a much higher reality, and one that is made up not of only disconjointed memories of out-of-body experiences, but actually embodied in a physical form in my own body and walking around in heaven, and at the very same time having experiences with pure spiritual beings, and who gave me the true destiny of life, which is to be as they, to be as I am. And that was a being of Rondadeck, Most High Observers. Yeah. One of the Rondadeck Most High. There are two. And there are two based here in our solar system. And many times on planet, they come on planet for specific influences, and including making shifts in our the way we do things, because if we continue on the way that we go on, many times it would cause the need for destruction, for a type of cleansing. Mm-hmm. But hopefully that doesn't need to be taken, because we can have a shift in the way we do things, and that may very well clean up the way we, the planet is becoming imbalanced in terms of its own science, and it's, you know, could very well cause irreparable harm to the destiny of the human race.
What did you say about the two Rondadecks?
There are two Rondadeck Most High Observers that are settled here in our solar system, and are also functioning primarily with our planet. They have the capacity to actually interfere with the human race. In other words, get involved in our politics, get involved in our wars, get involved with many things, and take sides according to their judgment. They're placed here because planet Earth was part of a rebellion. And if it had no rebellion and we were still on course, there would be no need for them to be affecting special changes in the way we do things. Whether it be our science or our politics, or, and many times they actually raise up and have in the past raised aloud or actually raised up personalities to change the destiny of a people. We find these heroes like David and Goliath. Primarily the human capacity was, they said, let's find ourselves a king, said the Israelites. And they looked up and they saw this giant guy. He was pretty big. He's a King Saul was head and shoulders above the rest of the Israelites. He was a big guy. and very handsome and intelligent too. But he was their human choice of a leader. But then they had to, battle with some other foreign people, which were the Philistines, who had another remnant of the influence of some genetics, which became known as the giants that they had, and he was Goliath, was one of a few brothers, and he was the biggest of all, and his spear was supposedly the size of a weaver's beam. A weaver's beam is approximately a small pole. It's about 4 inches in diameter, between 3 to 4 inches in diameter. And in other words, you couldn't get your hand around it. And
a weaver's what? Beam?
Beam, when they have a loom.
A loom, all right.
Yeah, so that a loom, they have this beam that runs back and forth.
It would travel back and forth.
Not the shuttle.
Not the shuttle.
But the beam that actually opens and closes.
You mean that pulls the yarn into it?
Yeah.
Tightens the yarn on the string it's on.
Well, the strings, the heaviest part of a loom.
Yes.
The big beam that all the threads are strung on.
It's got some weight behind it. All right, now I know what you mean.
Yeah. So anyway, that was what they were saying. The sword was actually quite big and quite heavy. But those swords of that time were essentially short swords. They weren't made long, like the steel swords. Mm-hmm. These were like bronze stuff, They're still in the Bronze Age. And what came up of it was a shepherd boy who was influenced. His observation was a nightly observation of the stars. His compositions of music showed a very close inclination to the divine voice. And he was chosen and went up there and became the champion and turned the entire direction of Israel around somewhat, but not necessarily perfected. Even his own son became extremely wise. Probably it was called the wisest man ever to live. And that wisdom would be a cute relationship between the divine voice and himself that made Solomon very wise. Practical application. In other words, the level of Solomon's common sense was high. There was very little confusion. He just used what basically was what we would call common sense. But if you have a confused person, what seems common sense to us, they couldn't make the same common sense choice because they got too many things confusing them. And that's what's happened to the human race.
Today, confusion.
Yeah, there are too many opinions, too many false sciences, right sciences. Who knows, And
sidetracked so many different ways.
Yeah, yeah. So these Verandadeks have come in and been involved in the affairs of the human race.
And are they still involved with us? Are they helping us?
Definitely. They still are. They're the ones that ordered, go shut down those nuclear missiles. Shut down the plants. They're getting too close to the button,
Good.
And people saw all these UFOs allowed to come in and actually tamper with the technology. Muck with it, break it, this was the orders that they have, the ability to give to give these orders. Interestingly enough, as one matures as a personality, as a divine son, a divine child, as you mature and are arranged with helpers, these are guardians, celestial guardians, like the Shaharuns, but more, even more personal. They can actually help choose your life destiny when you're going to make the wrong choice. In other words, they can see forward before you can see forward in time and see the outcome. In other words, through wisdom, because life circumstances are not always unique. They are many times very similar, and the outcomes may always find themselves being very similar. So it may keep you from making a wrong choice. That's been true for me. And also allow you to proceed in another choice that your life might be enriched, you know. At one point, I didn't know how I was going to travel the whole world. And now I travel the world almost when I feel like it. And that's because they arranged it. But it was over time. Uh-huh. You know, and it wasn't so that I would become filthy rich. But that the end result is I, you know, end up riding first class, probably more than the filthy rich sometimes, because the super filthy rich really have their own planes, you know. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about the lower kind of not so rich, but they occasionally get on first class. Mm-hmm. Now, this is pretty much what was happening and happens to me. And it was all by prearrangement. But coming to maturity in terms of, you might say, reward of enrichment of life. You know, Jesus Christ said something that is common to the program of the guardian angels. And he said, I have come to give you life and life abundantly. The guardian angels actually follow that pattern. In other words, they come to give, they're with you to give you life and to keep you from making big mistakes. And sometimes allowing you to make the big mistake so that you learn the true lessons of life. But that you might have life in abundance, a rich and enriched life that actually prepares one's soul for higher destiny attainment. Now, can you imagine making those stops into various celestial worlds? Over 600,000 that was named. I don't sure what the actual number really is right now, because it's grown considerably over time. They keep building them. And some of them are moving in great distances. So they're not fixed in orbit like the New Jerusalem is. The visitation of them would mean that you would be visiting light years apart into different domains of the universe, gaining and probably sharing a lot of wisdom. And without life experience, you cannot build true wisdom. You could have theory, but you wouldn't have true wisdom. In other words, having lived through it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're constantly learning, but the Veranda deck, this is very interesting how they can help us make the right choice and keep us from making the wrong choice.
And there are times in which they really come down to almost yelling at you.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yes. Something like that, you know. And if you don't listen to them, if it won't, you know, severely injure you or harm for you. I said, okay, learn the hard way. You know, and I let you go that. If you you go right around, you go through the hardship all over again until you learn it. And that's sometimes you like, but you swear you heard them tell you and warn you. You know, but the words of the world are very contrary to their words many times. You know.
Do you think the Veranda deck had led your children in the direction they went in and helped them along? You said they arranged it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I thought so.
That's why there is a type of blessedness, advantage, that happens when you become celestially arranged.
Michael, so you want to think this? So that's great.
You know, yeah, you get favor. You get favor.
I guess.
And that favor, even with your own idea of how to get this one thing, that sometimes it is not even close to where they want you to go, and you just sort of like have to live it through. Mm-hmm. But it ends up forming a real reality that is actually livable. You can actually live the reality of, you know, functioning with them. They're not there to make your life absolutely horrible. They give you challenges, change your attitude. There have been times I remember hearing the voice said, Michael, you need an attitude adjustment. Hmm. And I go, but they're wrong.
They don't know.
Yeah, they're wrong. Well, and it showed me, sure enough.
They weren't wrong.
Oh, maybe, but my attitude was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So just because someone is wrong doesn't, you know, eliminate them from the program.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, sometimes you got to kind of, you know, it's like, you know, these radical Islamic terrorists are wrong, you know. But does that mean that I should stop loving them? Stop saying that they're trying to discover truth? No. You know, but should I try to learn their way of being confused? Absolutely not. It's like, why learn darkness when you light exposes everything? So that's the trick, you might call it. If you learn to live in the light, even the darkest souls get illuminated close to you. And as I said, I got involved with real Al-Qaeda cell groups and actually was able to witness their weakness. They're more afraid of me than I was of them. You can imagine now, I'm surrounded by six of them. And one of them was seriously a Afghan, you know, he was in the Afghan-Russia war. You know, he did battle and probably killed people. But when I took a stand, he backed up. Because, you know, he better stay away from this guy. Don't come into, you know, range of his fist or whatever it is, his weaponry. So that was just posturing, you know what I mean? But it is an effective weapon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was put to use. But it also gave me a lesson to tell me that, wow, they're really around. And if you think that the confused people are not around, they're around, and they have an agenda that goes through generations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that must have been an interesting lesson to, you know, hey, are they really here? Or are they really around? Are they really affecting this? And then the more it happened to you, the more you probably thought,
no,
they really are here.
That happened before 9/11, before I even knew that they were, you know, a real big threat. I mean, there was the bomb that went off in the World Trade Center that didn't do much damage.
93.
Yeah. And then after that, you know, it made them look stupid. But after 9/11, I remembered that incident. I said, damn, they were here. And, you know, went up to look at if they were still there, and the place was vacated. But Osama bin Laden's picture became well publicized, and I said, darn, that's a picture he was on the wall of the guy. I said, this is your leader. And he says, yes. I said, oh, he looks like a good man. Because Osama bin Laden has a kind of a baby face in the picture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I said, well, he looks like a kind of good guy. You know, he's very good man. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You Americans are nothing but cowards. It's still that way, you know. And there's a way in which seems right, that end is the ways of death. And many times that's cowardice in terms of the opponents. Mm-hmm. So what looks politically correct is going to be used as a way to kill you, you know. We're going to get these guys doing politically correct things so that we can sneak up and cut their throats.
The bad ones, anyway.
Yeah, well, that's their theme, yeah. So, and they call being, you know, that political correctness or politics, the American style of politics, mm-hmm. is cowardice.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's less cowardice seen in the news these days, in the last few days, in the last week. And what's to come is going to be very interesting. Yeah, we will see. Did I lose Michael?
Nope.
You didn't lose me. Okay, good.
I'm just listening to what you were saying.
Well, it's intense, and I wonder if the Veranda Deck are helping in this in this effort, but it certainly seems that there's a whole new power structure going on.
Yeah, well, I came into this year being told there's a paradigm shift. You know, when you look at a paradigm, the paradigm of a big paradigm is political way, governance is, and that shift, not just moving from one political structure to another, but a whole new way. When you talk about a paradigm shift, you look at a whole new way of doing something. And that whole new way, you know, when you look at the possibility of the whole new way in terms of the governance of our country, the United States of America, is that it starts probably from the top. And, you know, that paradigm is a personality that does not function under the present paradigm, which is puppetry, you know, strings attached. And it goes back to, you know, money. You know, it says, I care not who is in power or whatever. Just give me control over their money. And then I'll have everything I need to control them. Well, if you don't have that control, and then the strings are not attached. So that's a new paradigm that hasn't been in functioning at all. You know, it's this paradigm. Yeah, I got to get this.
Okay. Hold on. Oh, Okay, there it is. Now we're moving again. Okay, Michael's back. Well, this is has been very interesting about the Varana decks and how they can arrange things. And
it can actually get involved with the affairs of wars, planetary politics. They can raise up a personality from, like I was giving the idea of David and being a young boy, a shepherd boy. Mm-hmm. But he was essentially being brought up, being readied for an assignment. This goes in alignment with, what I'm a part of is called the the Reserve Corps, the Human Reserve Corps, the Mortal Corps of Destiny. So they go through, like David was going through a preparation for a particular thing, which really culminated in his willingness to take on a giant. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But during that time, he had arranged a great amount of faith between himself and the divine, and the trust in that voice. It says, well, you can take on that lion, because there were lions at the time, not only wolves, but lions that threatened the herds, the sheep. So he killed them with a slingshot, and it was a very effective weapon. He probably practiced all the time, because there's something called 10,000 hours. If one practices something for 10,000 hours, they'll become a master at it. And 10,000 hours is hours. 10,000, 1,000 hours 10 times. It's a level of when you look at the old apprentice schedule, how long a person would have to stay in apprenticeship, it matches 10,000 hours. Mm-hmm. People would say you have to be an apprentice for 2 years or something like that, 3 years or something. Comes close to that. Well, his apprenticeship was under the divine leader leading, because he was all by himself. The shepherds do not operate in, in groups, Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, he was a absolute part of the Mortal Corps of Destiny. Right now, the Mortal Corps of Destiny includes several thousand people, growing daily. Having been, for myself, prepared for an exposure of even the Mortal Corps program, which has a lot to do with implementing the programs, you might say, orchestrated by the Varanda decks themselves, under the free will choice of serving under the Creator Son that we know as the Lord Jesus Christ. And they operate with the very same lordship. So many times they do not refuse being called Lord, because it comes with the very same, you might call it, instruction, mm-hmm. Or the authority.
Mm. Wow. Amazing. Hearing this in this way. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk to you next time. And just next, we'll say aloha now and pick this up again. I'd like to hear more about the Varana deck. I like hearing how they arrange things. And
yeah, this is not necessarily found in the Irancha book. There are hints about that in the Hiranya book. But the Hiranya book does go and go through a lot on the Most High observers, the Virandadek Most Highs, the fact of how many are posted in a rebellion, torn world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or system. Yeah.
All right. I'll talk to you next time, Michael. Aloha.
Okay. Aloha.
Aloha.